You know how people say age is just a number? Well, turns out they were kind of right. Your calendar age doesn't always reflect how old your body actually is. I recently learned this when I took the True Age test from True Diagnostic. I was a little nervous to find out my real age, but get this, my biological age came back 6 years younger than my actual age. I was considering hanging my results on the fridge like we did for our kiddos when they were little. But here's the thing. It wasn't just a vanity boost. The test showed how different systems in my body are aging, like my brain, heart, immune system, and metabolism. Apparently, my brain is doing great, but my metabolic health needs a little TLC. So now I've got personalized tips, backed by science, to improve that and slow aging overall. And honestly, the test was super easy. Just a painless finger prick, pop the sample in the mail, and a couple weeks later, I had this incredibly detailed report that made me rethink how I eat, sleep, and manage stress. If you care about protecting your health and want to find out what your real age is, head over to truediagnostic.com and use my code MINDFUL to get 20% off your entire order or subscription. That's truediagnostic.com, code MINDFUL at checkout. Your future self will thank you.
You're trying to attract the divine to awaken into your life. It's inside of you, but it's dormant, sleeping, unattracted to what's going on in your life. So how are you going to awaken it? How are you going to attract it into your life? Now let's have that conversation. It's not with your fancy designer suit. It's not with the restaurant that you take them to. It's not by how much money you have. That conversation now needs to happen. And I usually break it down. What I've learned from my guru, my teacher, is that there are qualities, virtues that a human being can develop in irrespective of their life circumstances that are seen as the most attractive things to that divinity. So chief amongst them is humility, number one. So humility is the number one quality that can attract divinity into your life as a magnetic principle.
Swami Revati, thank you for joining me on the Mindful Movement Podcast.
Thank you, my honor.
You are dressed, I don't know, are you a monk of some sort?
I am. I'm a Hindu monk, yeah.
Hindu monk, okay. That sounds pretty intense of a lifestyle.
It is less intense than people imagine it is, but probably more intense than the average life, yeah.
You're the host of the Thinking Bhakti podcast also, and in preparation for this, I listened to some of your content recently, and honestly, your voice is so soothing. I had trouble because I just wanted to fall asleep. You have a very deep, soothing voice. It's very useful for if you're talking as your primary line of work.
Thank you very much. I mean, hopefully not to put people to sleep.
But... Well, I gathered some of the impressive insights along the way too, but something that I noticed, it was very relaxing to listen to you.
Thank you very much.
So you're a Hindu monk and you live on an ashram in upstate New York, and you basically spend your time kind of spreading the wisdom that you've taken in over the years?
I lived for almost 16 years at an ashram in Europe with my spiritual teacher, Paramahamsa Vishwananda. And so out of those 16 years that I lived with him, obviously a lot of that was spent studying, learning, imbibing, growing. And a lot of the intent of our, if you want to call it movement, whatever you want to speak of it as, is to help people. It's to spread wisdom. It's to meet people where they are. It's to help them connect with the divine, connect with their inner selves. And so a lot of what I do now is basically living in the ashram, but on the weekends, traveling, doing lectures, events, classes, speaking, my podcast, all sorts of things like that. But the main intent is one and the same. It's just helping people to connect with something a little more true.
Okay. That sounds great. I think I remember listening that you weren't really born into this. I think you said you grew up in Brazil. Can you talk a little bit about of the transition and what drew you to Hinduism?
Yeah, of course. I'm Brazilian. My family's Brazilian. I grew up in a series of different countries because my family was moving a lot when I was younger, and it exposed me to a lot of different cultures. And so I think one of the things that helped me transition into this in some sense was my openness to a lot of different ways of looking at life because of my travels in my younger years. In Brazil, it's quite common to have some form of faith in a higher power without a label. So it's not so much that I was Christian in a very traditional sense or anything of the sort, believing in a higher power, yes, not an atheist, but without a strict framework. And so my mother was a pretty strong meditator. She used to meditate a lot, and she was really inclined towards Eastern spirituality. And I think it meant that I was just a little more open to that, a little more exposed to it, more receptive. I liked a lot of the maybe key principles that were in Hinduism intuitively. So things like God coming in any which form he so pleases to. It's not a limitation of one name, one identity, but rather whatever way the divine wishes to present itself to whomever. That felt more aligned with me, with a limitless, boundless higher power, so to speak. So things like that, I think, intuitively attracted me. But when I was 15 years old, I met my spiritual teacher, as I mentioned before, and he, I think, was the biggest catalyst for me taking any of this more seriously. Like, I wasn't a teenager pursuing a spiritual life in a very intense way. I was pursuing other things. But meeting him for me was a catalyst in the sense that he was unlike anybody else I'd ever met. And even at 15 years old, I could understand that. I could feel that and see that. He just seemed a little happier than other people I had met. And it actually made me feel a little intimidated. I was kind of like, what do you know that I don't? Because this is uncanny how happy and like how much I feel it basically emanating from you. It's like a weird thing to describe. And it stuck with me. After my first meeting with him, I had his smile sort of ingrained in my head because it was from that moment on what I was comparing my life to. So I was doing my fun stuff that I love to do, go out sports, go out with my friends and chase girls, whatever it was. And I would like somehow try to catch a mirror to see, is my smile like his smile? And it wasn't. And so, long story short, I circled back around to him in through different ways. And at some point, I remember just asking him, like, is there a way that you can teach me to be more like you? And he just sort of had an easy smile on his face, and he said, "Of course I can." And so that was the simplicity of how this project, this endeavor started. From there, of course, you know, as I said, I've been now in this path for 20 years, and so it'd be hard to condense a lot of that into
Right.
one answer, but it
Well,
started from that.
what did that look like at that moment, though? I mean, when he said, "Yeah, I can teach you," is that like come, just live in an ashram where I am and just do all the daily activities I do, or?
Good question. No, it's I mean, he has many students all over the world, and actually I would say 95% of them, 90% of them are not monastics at all, right? They're just regular people, in so much as that means something these days, doing normal jobs. And the monastic thing is much more the niche, the rarer thing. What it looked like was starting to understand the framework that that he participates in or teaches of Hindu belief. So maybe going a little bit beyond the externalities, because the problem with Hinduism is that it's so tied to Indian culture, it's so tied to a lot of the visuals being quite, you know, extreme and different from what maybe Western people are used to. So it was about understanding the answers that it provides to the more fundamental questions of life. Who am I? Where do I come from? Where am I going? These types of things. And then from that, having techniques or having tools that would basically start to propel me forward on a journey of personal growth, but more specifically, connection with the divine. So it's a very theistic path in that sense.
Okay. What are some of those fundamentals? Like when you say it helps you, answer questions like who am I, maybe why are we here, meaning of life, whatever, purpose. I know very little bit about Hinduism. I've heard it. I mean, I went through a decade and a half or so of a lot of like spending time in the self-help aisle of bookstores, if you will. And a lot of that had, pulled from different ideologies from around the world, and there were some that alluded to different, Hindu ideas, but not like a real base learning education of where that comes from. What are some of like the fundamental things that, if you were trying to teach someone that really didn't know much at all, that kind of make it different or unique to itself?
Yeah, I would say that there is one, I would say, underlying idea that is super, super important, which is the idea of what we call dharma. So dharma meaning actually purpose. So the idea of dharma is that everything in this world has a purpose inherently. And yes, you have freedom of will to choose to not follow it, to do other things, whatever, but inherently there is purpose to everything. There is, in a sense, a eternal purpose. For souls, for people like you and I, it's meant to be a reconnection with divinity, but that's in the bigger picture purpose, the big P purpose. In our day-to-day lives, we can live purposeful lives by aligning ourselves with that higher purpose and then creating an entire lifestyle, an entire outlook on the world that supports that higher lifestyle. So one of the literal translations of the word dharma is that which supports. So that which supports what we're trying to achieve. And so, for example, it places quite a strong emphasis on conduct, on character development and conduct. So it's about living a life that you can be proud of in some sense, and I mean that on a more ethical, moral perspective, and then gradually adopting behaviors that check the boxes of life. So when I say check the boxes of life, Hinduism will basically break down the human life into four segments. And it will say that there are these four segments, these four boxes that you have to check in order to have a complete life or a fulfilled life. And so the first one is your duties, ethics, and morals. That's the first one that ideally you should learn in your youth as you're coming up in the world. Okay. Then the second box is material prosperity. So you should have enough to be able to sustain yourself, security for yourself and those that are, around you, your loved ones. The third box is enjoyment. You should actually enjoy life. And you should therefore do things as long as they don't transgress on the first box of your ethics, morals, and duties to make sure you're having enough fun, enough fuel in the tank to face the difficulties of life. And the fourth one is freedom. In the more spiritual, theological sense, it means liberation. So Hindus, of course, believe in reincarnation. And so it's about liberating yourself from that cycle. But in a more practical level, in a more pragmatic level, it means just freedom. So what it means is that you don't entangle yourself with your sources of pleasure, with your sources of material prosperity, with your duties and responsibilities. Because a lot of the time, what happens is people pursue these things. They have material wealth, they have a lot of joy, but they have it not in a way of I'm connected, and if needed, I can disconnect from it, but they have it in a very entangled way, which means that
Gotcha.
if any of those things change, if something like that is removed from your life, you break down. You have nothing left in a sense, right? And so,
So freedom really speaks to like non-attachment.
yeah, in a more poetic way, because obviously when you start talking to people about this detachment, non-attachment, my experience is a lot of people treat it as a very cold thing, as something like, oh, that means I can't have things, I can't do things, and it's not really about that at all.
That's interesting. It's an interesting structure. There's like a simplicity to it. So the idea would be to go through these steps so that your overall purpose of connecting to what you would consider divinity or God, as you guys see it, so that when you are reincarnated, like you are a step forward, or you're not like punished, or like, can you speak to the reincarnation idea a little bit? Because what does that mean? Like, does that mean we come back as another person in a different place, in a different time?
So no rewards, no punishments. That isn't the mechanism. So the way it works is you essentially achieve or attain to what you want. And what you want means essentially if you remain attached to this reality, or you're attached to goals, ambitions, your identity, this body, whatever you want to call it, then upon departing this earth, what happens is that your soul, which we believe to be something separate from our mind-body complex, essentially once again is propelled towards that which you had as your deepest rooted attachment and desire. So it's in a sense, you get what you ask for. So because you wanted this, more of this, at the moment of death, you didn't want to end all this, your soul continues in a new body, a new vehicle, but once again returning into this platform of existence. And this is not seen as a punishment. It is seen as the natural consequence of your own desires, of your own, let's say, will to live in this manner. And so that's point one. The Bhagavad Gita is our great wisdom text, let's put it like this. It has an entire framework as to how this is viewed and how it dictates outcomes of human life. So what it says is, at the moment of your death, whatever you're thinking of, to that you will go. So then people go, great, I'll just cheat the system. I'll live however I want. And then last second, God, and then off I go. But the Bhagavad Gita says, no, unfortunately, that won't work. So unfortunately, your last thought will inevitably be the outcome of the life you've lived. And so what they mean by that is you can't cheat your inner programming. Attachment is attachment. You can't fake it. You can't just reduce it to a strategy. So what that means is that if your house is suddenly on fire, what are you going in there to get? Right? If you can only get one item out of that house, you can't pretend that you're going to get the righteous thing. You'll get what actually means the most to you, right? And so the same principle applies here. It's you can't cheat your own conscience in that sense. You die with the attachments that you have, that you've cultivated, that you've nurtured throughout your life. And so the idea of reincarnation is you just simply move into another phase of your life, your soul's existence, where you continue in the pursuit of that which you are longing for. And so what we believe, spiritually speaking, is as long as you long for material things, you will have pleasures and great joy, and you will have suffering. It oscillates, because that's the nature of this world. Everything has a beginning and an end. And so as long as the ice cream is in your hand, you're enjoying it. But once it's finished, game's done. And so the same idea is then, I would say, extrapolated into something bigger, which is if you therefore want to achieve true fulfillment and true spiritual success, you attain what we would call the big G-O-D, God, because that is without end. And the source of love and the source of happiness and the source of whatever it is that you're longing for that stems from that connection is without end. And therefore, there is no longer this oscillation of happiness and sadness, the highs and the lows. And that's what we're therefore orientating our life towards. And the four boxes that I told you about before, they're, in a sense, the foundation for that relationship to flourish. If you haven't got those boxes checked, then essentially we're saying at one point or another of your spiritual journey and your spiritual pursuit, that's going to be compromised by your lack in that box. Your not having checked that box is going to pull you into some form of discomfort or some form of unrest where you will have to pursue those things again. So it's a quote-unquote distraction until you check the box.
Interesting. You alluded to the Bhagavad Gita a moment ago. I remember I listened to that a couple times. I don't know if it was like an abridged version I maybe heard on Audible. But also a moment ago, you mentioned the idea about free will. And one thing that I felt like I was getting out of that book is that maybe that's not a thing, or that my interpretation of that book was that they were making the case that you didn't really have the free will that you think you have, mm-hmm. and that there is a cumulative momentum that is built into every moment, that you're going to operate or show up in the world in that moment only one way, and only one way you're going to do it, which always ticks me off when I hear people like, oh, if I was them, I would do this. And I'm like, no, if you were them, you'd do the same thing they do, because they're doing it because they don't have a choice in that moment. Is that one of the messages like that of that book or that scripture or the religion itself? Is it considered a religion? Am I even using that word right?
I mean, the thing is, what does that even mean to most people anymore, right?
What is it pointing to?
Does it resemble a religion? Yes. Right? I mean, I would call it more of a spiritual tradition, but then what does that mean also? So it's just, you know, in the end of the day, people associate different things with these words. But
gotcha.
Sure. So about free will, it's a great question, by the way. I think what the Bhagavad Gita does is it presents a middle ground between full deterministic reality and free will. It talks about, in a sense, a conditioned will. So a conditioned will means that there are a certain set of parameters that you can't change. You can't change them. You can't will them to be different. There's nothing you can do about it. Why? Because they are the consequences of forward-moving momentum, as you said, previous choices. So the consequences of our previous choices lead us into situations by which we have to face their outcomes. And the choices that we have are primarily how do we respond to those outcomes as the next sort of step. But the event itself cannot be avoided or changed. And so what we look at it in the law of karma is that there will be moments in our life that we are inevitably being propelled towards. because they are consequences of previous chains of cause and effect that we are participating in. Of course, this ties into reincarnation, right? We're talking about a long chain of causality that leads us to where we are, but we have agency, especially internally, insofar as we cognize these events and how we frame them in our minds and therefore how we respond to them. Because how you store an experience or a memory inside of you informs how you're going to move forward in the future and how you're going to take other decisions or choices in the future. So maybe one little extra point is, we believe in a framework of relationship with the divine by which the divine is present within us as a sort of observer. And so what that means is that although I may will something, that doesn't mean I'm able to guarantee its outcome or its manifestation. So I think of something in my mind that I want to pursue. I want to go and eat pizza. So I have willed that. I want pizza. That doesn't mean I'm actually going to get pizza. So having a desire for something or an idea that I want to do something doesn't mean outcomes are produced. And so I think sometimes we need to break down the conversation from, do we have freedom of thought versus freedom of outcomes? Freedom of outcomes, I think nobody's really arguing. We can't manifest reality exactly how we want it when we want it. But freedom of thought in that moment, am I able to think differently than I have been conditioned or programmed to think? And so I think these are the two real interesting domains. First, the karmic events in our life that we can't avoid. So the external events that have to happen, that are outside of our control. We don't will them to happen. I don't will it to rain tomorrow. I don't will to get a flat tire. I don't will all these kind of weird things. They happen to me. And then the second domain, which is, like I said, the inner one. The inner one, if I could simplify it by my mental state, do I have really freedom to think and choose as I will? Not really. So as you were alluding to, if I was in that person's shoe, would I do it differently? The answer is no, not really. Because you have that person's set of autopilot programmings, the code that person has, you would have to have too. And that code has been ingrained, has been built. We call it a nature. So that nature has been ingrained in the person that predicates that person's response to whatever it will be. However, and this is the final thing I'll say on this, you can change it. You can change that nature with conscious action. You can start to change your wiring, change your conditioning, so that when the next thing happens, your automatic autopilot response to that thing will be different.
So, a couple things here. So one, I feel like that whole idea is really helps encourage us to be a more compassionate species in some way, because you can see somebody that you think would be like, why are they living that way? Maybe it's harming others or harming themselves, but it's like, it's because they don't actually have a choice. And also, how do you, when you say you could change that, you still need some reference. Like, I wonder, so like, let me think of a scenario. Like, you could look at, let's say somebody grows up in, I live not far from Baltimore. Baltimore City is, I've really watched it over the years, and it's kind of challenging to observe Baltimore City in many ways. And the structural, cultural issues that make it much harder for a young person to come out of there and have like what most people would consider like good outcomes. Like, let's say you are born in the inner city and you're born into a broken home. And there's no, let's say, male role model. Every male in your life, as you're a young male, is either dealing in drugs or violence. And that is the norm. So you don't really have a reference. And maybe you're lucky enough to have a mother that's working three jobs to keep food on the table. And maybe there's a grandmother involved that's helping you. And you have, like, you're just hanging on. And there's like a lot of that scenario. And I wonder, like, one, well, how does that person have a reference? If all they know in life is that, why wouldn't they think that that is what life is and should be? But also, in that same scenario, you could have, let's say, twins. You could have two mm-hmm. young boys growing up in that same environment. And maybe something that grandmother said one day was interpreted differently in one than the other, that plants a seed that makes that person want to get out of that environment and make different choices. So on one hand, it's like, because I feel like free will is not really what we think it is, it helps to be compassionate for a person to be like, I get it. Like, I wish it wasn't so, but I understand how somebody gets where they are. And also, like, is it just luck if you're the person that interprets that external input differently to make you change the way? Like, how does somebody change the way they think about something without that information coming from somewhere? Is that literally, does Hinduism look at that as that's the divine emerging a thought and idea from within that's just blossoming in that person somehow as just a part of nature?
There's a mixture of things, but yes, the divine is part of the answer. So the point of your observation is spot on in the sense that it is like a compassion-inducing situation because you do understand that the circumstances dictate the person's scenario to a large degree. But the one thing I will say is we don't believe people are born as blank slates. So you're not born a blank slate where you're just purely a byproduct of your environment. You're also born with a continued nature from your previous birth, right? So the twin scenario is very relevant in that sense because they're not, as much as they're physically twins, they're not spiritually twins. So in that sense, they do have two distinct natures. And so the way one reacts or another is inherently different, right? Because they're not carbon copies of each other in that sense. And so that's an important distinction to make too. Now, how the person in that setting gets help or gets that reference, two things. One is human, one is divine. So on the human level, one of the things the Bhagavad Gita tells us to do is exactly this. How you, quote unquote, help people or preach to people is not through words. So it says, rather than disturbing the minds of the ignorant, as it labels it, live your life in an exemplary or devotional sense in such a way that you can inspire people to want to live likewise. And so that is a call to action to, first of all, live in the public eye, to not isolate yourself, to not run to a cave, to not sort of hide. If you have any ounce of wisdom available to you, or you have the privilege to live in certain circumstances that are not like the ones you described, then you should be looking to not, let's say, point the finger and not sort of score points with your beautiful flowery words, but rather to just go and do your life in an exemplary way. It means literally work, show up, take responsibility, do it with devotion and love and positivity. People will be subconsciously imprinted by that. And those things start to turn the wheels inside, create different reference points, as you were pointing out. And so then comes the role of the divine. The divine in Hinduism acts in a very reciprocal way. So it acts in a very magnetic way. So what that means is, as you start to cultivate a sincere desire for change, as you start to cultivate positive traits, for example, humility and others like it, then we are of the firm belief that the divine responds to that as a magnetism. The divine is called by those virtues, not by prayer necessarily. It's not by someone going to the temple room or to the church and saying, God, come help me out of this predicament. It's more the sincerity that is behind that prayer. It's more the longing for change or the longing for something better or something of that nature. It's the qualities that attract divinity to come. And what the divinity does is, yeah, you mentioned planting a thought in the mind. Usually it'll be a little less internal and more, it will create the circumstances like an architect of life. It will create the circumstances for us to be given an opportunity to change. It's just opportunities. It's not a guarantee. It's not that the divine comes, presses a magic button, and now you're living a very different life. It's more, as you have called for change, I provide you the opportunity. Right? Life provides us the opportunity as a result of our sincere call for change. And then comes the third part of this puzzle, which is, but what if it still isn't enough? What if the person fails? What if the person doesn't see the opportunity, doesn't take the opportunity? Well, that's why I say Hinduism has to be seen in a much bigger perspective. It doesn't talk about a one-life scenario. We have multiple lives, which means that everything is part of a larger evolutionary story of that person's journey. So in this life, they may go through some difficulties. For sure, they may go through some difficulties, and maybe they don't figure it out. Maybe they don't step out of that, and they live a life that is less than ideal. But that isn't the end of their journey.
In the regard of like the reincarnation stuff, how does Hinduism look at like the really unlucky, bad suffering, like, you know, freak accident stuff? Is that on some level like something being brought forward from the past, or is there also like room for just random shit that happens?
Yeah, no, not really. So this is the one thing that people struggle to get to grips with. A lot of people love karma, like even non-Hindus, right? They love the idea of karma. Right. Karma's great. Except when you really buy into the Hindu framework, there's no such thing as karma joint with injustice. So karma is just karma. So we don't have to label it as good. That's the other thing. Just because something is karmic doesn't mean it's a good thing. You can still say objectively, that's not a good outcome and we would love to change that. But what we don't say is that it's an unfair random thing. What we'll say is that there is a causal chain that has created that situation. But rather than wrestle with that, let's wrestle with the solution. So one of the analogies that is often given is if you're caught in a burning house, the one thing you're not going to do is sit there and say, well, how did this fire start? This is bizarre. What you'll do is just get out, right? And so I think similarly, we have this situation here by which we accept everything is governed by this impersonal law of karma. It's not a, you know, punishments and rewards principle. It's just direct causality. And therefore, everything has been caused by one thing or another. And if we had a big enough superintelligence, supercomputer, you'd be able to track that causal chain. And you would be able to see why things are happening the way they are at all instances and not ascribe anything to randomness.
Well, that might be ahead of us.
Yeah, it might be. It sure might be. I think the only thing that we would say to that is that there would still be one agent that computer would not be able to track because it's not of the same substance. So we would make a dichotomy between material nature and spiritual nature, right? So the spiritual agent of action, meaning either the divine or our own soul, would not be measurable by the computer. Not the same paradigms of existence, let's put it like this. But everything in this realm, yes, sure.
Maybe one day it will be measurable. We just don't have the instrument. Like sometimes I think about our sensory like organs, and you know, I think that they've emerged as a function to need to survive. So like our eyes see the things we see because we need to. And we hear, I think there's a lot we don't know yet of what our body is perceiving. Like you could feel energy. Like you talked earlier about, you know, you don't want to go in hiding, you know, if you have something to learn. Like if you're vibing on that frequency, you know, we harmonize, we resonate. So like the reason, like when you met that teacher, he was radiating an energy that you picked up on, and you were, you know, somehow falling into coherence with him. And like that is going on all the time. And I just wonder, like, are we as a species going to really pick up, especially as we don't need the other ones as much, what kind of sensory things are we going to be able to pick up? Are we going to be collectively better at that? And what does that look like?
But my argument there is that you can, the human species can already do that, but it just requires a sort of growth process, an investment into self in order to be able to attune to that. But I have met several people who have these faculties far more developed than others. So, I mean, if you're talking about it as a collective, as a, just a general biological evolution, that it's not something that you, like the same way we don't learn to see with our eyes, it just happens naturally, then sure, maybe further down the road, would be I to say yes or no to that. But my point is that these tools, these capacities are already available to people for actually a really long time. I mean, we just call them either yogis or mystics or freaks or whatever, you know.
But can't you measure God as you feel it? Like, I think the impression I get is this is an experiential process. So right. It's like I could tell you, it's this, it's that. And I know a lot of religions try to do that. Maybe it's in good faith. They're just trying to make sense of things and have some kind of scaffolding to work from. But ultimately, it seems like they all speak to some experiential thing that it's, you know, within you. But in that, which I assume with all the work that you've done and all the practice I would assume there's countless hours you have sitting in some type of practice where you are trying to cultivate a deeper connection. And in doing so, you sense that connection. You mm-hmm. are measuring it. You might not be like quantifying it, but there's a quality that you're experiencing.
I agree. And I don't think same for everybody. That's the point I'm trying to make, because it's somehow directly correlated to the amount of investment you put into this.
Right. Yeah, you could, like any tool, if you work it, it sharpens or strengthens it. But it just it makes me wonder, like, is that measuring? Like you're experiencing it. Maybe that is the measurement. I don't
Yeah,
know.
I know, I do agree with you. I think it's, look, when we talk about measuring it, experiencing it, I think that is the crux of it. We orientate our lives around that which we experience, I think, much more than the theoretical. And I think that having said that, we do experience it to some degree. I just don't think that we're very good at communicating it, at demonstrating it to someone else. As a spiritual speaker, it would be the easiest thing in the world if I could just open my heart and show you the, open
Right.
my mind and like experience what I've experienced. Easy, job done. But instead, I have to play with words and I have to explain abstract ideas and concepts. And you're absolutely right. When it comes to religion and divinity, I mean, one of the things that I push back against the most is this hyper definition of the transcendent, as if we've somehow got the appropriate words and thoughts as reference points to explain what it is. We don't. And so I think it's one of those things of saying, hey, here's the closest approximation, or here's a framework that you can live by to orientate your life. But ultimately, this is a personally experiential process where you've got to do this, 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 and that. And then it goes into the realm of the undescribable. You're going to experience things that we don't have the words to communicate, and you don't have the brain references to understand what I'm saying anyway. So this is something that you have to experience. I can tell you as much as I want what oranges taste like. If you've never tasted an orange, it means nothing to you. Right? And so this is the point where I'm much more aiming to entice you into your own exploratory journey, and I can give you tools and a framework, and then you go for it. And then we'll circle back and see how similar our experiences are. And maybe we'll be able to express that to each other without words. Who knows?
Right. Well, what are some of those tools? I know personally that I have experienced moments through using different tools, whether it's meditation, breath work, drugs, just unexplainable moments of like spontaneous emotional stuff where I have felt like there is that I'm on some level like tapping into something where I am part of something much bigger that permeates everything. And I don't know if that's what somebody would call connection with the divine. I don't know. I know that they're important experiences for me and have been. What are some of the tools? Like, I guess in the maybe they're work in those 4 steps that you give, I assume like in part in step one or whatever, it's like, well, how do you live? You have some kind of practice to cultivate whatever that connection is.
Right.
What are the
Yeah.
strategies and tools?
Great question. So normally, traditionally in the Hindu framework, you'll have yoga. I mean, and now yoga, not necessarily as, again, it's not limited to physical practices. Yoga is just a word that means union, right? So union between yourself and your higher self, union between yourself and the divine. In whatever framework you see, you choose to accept it. Yoga means that. And the yoga process goes through a transition or transformation of mind. That's universal to all forms of yoga. There is a transformation of mind that you're trying to create. And so from attached to the sort of externalities and false conceptions of self, so ego-based identity, which we would call as a false conception of self, to a true nature. So the wisdom texts of yoga have been saying for thousands of years that the point of yoga is to awaken your true nature. Whatever that means, just right now we're just parking abstract ideas, right? And then you have different specific types of yoga that approach this slightly differently. So I'll say, I'll mention three of the most popular. So karma yoga. Karma yoga literally means that you live a life of selfless service. So it doesn't matter necessarily what you do, it matters how you do it. So it doesn't aim to change your practices and tools as much as it changes your intention, your motivation. So in the Bhagavad Gita, it teaches you about karma yoga, and it says, therefore, act out of a sense of duty, act out of a sense of welfare for as many beings as possible, not out of a sense of self-fulfillment or self-gratification, right? So motivation changing from selfish to selfless, or from selfish to as beneficial as possible to as many people as possible, is step one. And then step two of karma yoga is detach from all outcomes. So do not remain attached to the outcome of action. Just do your best and leave the rest, right? Now, as simple as that is karma yoga. And the premise is that the more I disassociate from my sense of ego, neither in the motivations or in the outcomes of actions, you essentially are creating distance between yourself and your ego identity. And when you do that, when you sever those ties between you and this ego identity, you see yourself as part of the whole. You will start to experience yourself as interconnected with everything, right? And in that point, in that situation, essentially you are now living your authentic nature, because the interconnectedness is seen as the real vision of reality. The separation and individualism is seen as the false version of reality.
Gotcha. So the tool in that case is really that intention, that selfless service intention that leads to...
And the detachment.
And the detachment. Okay. Right.
That's karma yoga. So that's okay. One very popular way, because it doesn't ask you to change anything. You do, right? Continue your career.
It's just a mindset.
Right. Exactly. Then you have jnana yoga. So jnana yoga, jnana means knowledge, the knowledge yoga. That one's a little different in the sense that it asks you now to do something very specific as a tool. So there's a meditation called neti neti. In Sanskrit, it literally just means not this, not this. And it's an introspective, analytical practice where you identify everything you can observe about yourself. And then you assert whether that is who you are or not. So the premise is, I am not my thoughts, I am not my emotions, I am not this body, I am not this, I am not that. And as you go removing the layers of the onion, the idea is that eventually you'll find what you actually are at the core. Okay? Now, the problem with this path is this would be the path of most ascetics, people who run off to the cave and become, you know, let's say, renunciants of this world and become full-time yogis and whatever else you would call it. The problem with this, it's a path of self-negation, right? It's not a very joyful path. It's not the most fun thing in the world. It's really, you have to buy into the idea that this world around you is ultimately illusory, unreal. And therefore, you don't want to engage further into it. You want to peel back all layers of falsehood that have been established within in order to find the seed inside, the core, the truth. Okay.
And you're sucking out the part three, the enjoyment.
I fully agree. So those who practice jnana yoga often struggle with that third box. What they'll tell you, having spoken to many practitioners of jnana yoga, is that there is great joy in removing a layer of falsehood. There is great joy to be found in detaching yourself from something that you now see to be unreal, right? And there may be something to it. There may be something to that, right? So that is the second type. And so the tool there is really about physical renunciation, not so much a mental one, that you actually physically take distance from the material world and you introspect into this removal meditation. And it can take a long time, and just as much as it can be a quick thing. Depends on the person. And lastly, the third one I wanted to talk about is bhakti yoga. So it means the yoga of devotion. And so in this one, the yoga of devotion, it's the only one that's collaborative. So you'll have noticed that in the first two, there was no mention of God or divinity or anything like that. In the third one, it's a collaborative process in the sense that a partnership is struck with God in which you, the practitioner, you say, I'm going to devote myself to that higher power. That's what bhakti means, devotion. So in service, in worship, in whatever you want to frame it as, because we believe that worship and service are literally just the verbs of love, love in action. So I will render actions of love towards that divinity, and then it becomes incredibly important to understand what that divinity is. It's not a man in the sky, right? It's an all-pervading presence. So within you, within me, within my neighbor, within everybody. So I will begin to genuinely offer acts of love, service to all around me, but directed at divinity. And the idea is, because I want to create, as I was describing earlier, the magnetism that attracts that being or that presence of that being to awaken within me and to manifest into my life more presently. Because by doing so, what is essentially happening is that all that which I am lacking, i.e. true vision, true cognition of who I am, what this world is and what it is not. So some of the things that karma yoga and jnana yoga are trying to achieve will be given to me by the mere presence of that divinity in our life. So it's like if you just turn on the light, the darkness is gone, right? That kind of analogy. So if you're in the middle of darkness, turn on the light in the room and the darkness is gone. So by attracting that supreme light into our lives, then the darkness is automatically removed. Okay. Bhakti yoga, therefore, is in many ways a very enjoyable path because it's a path that is life-affirming rather than life-denying. You're supposed to go and meet the world. You're supposed to go and meet the world in love, in service, and it's relational. So it introduces the idea of grace. Grace will come into my life to fill the gaps that I have been unable to fulfill by myself through my own endeavors and efforts. However, it is not a cop-out. So a lot of people take bhakti yoga as, oh, I'll just sort of pray and God will take care of everything. God will do everything for me. And all realizations will just fall on my lap. That is not the principle of bhakti yoga, right? You have to, if you really love someone, if you're really in a love relationship, then a huge part of that is how you show up to that relationship. It's in, and so I, when I teach bhakti yoga, by the way, I practice bhakti yoga as my chosen method. When I teach bhakti yoga to people, I build it on very human building blocks. So basically step one is, how do you live a human relationship well? And people will start to tell me all these different qualities and things that you have to do. And I'm like, great, do the same thing now towards the divine. Don't need to complicate it further than that. So if you're going to woo the divine, you're trying to catch a lady, you're trying to be in a relationship with someone new, what are you going to do? You're going to dress nicely, you're going to show up on time, you're going to bring gifts, you're going to smell good, you're going to present the best version of yourself because you're trying to attract someone. So very, very basically, I say to someone, okay, so now I ask you, you're trying to attract the divine to awaken into your life. It's inside of you, but it's dormant, sleeping, unattracted to what's going on in your life. So how are you going to awaken it? How are you going to attract it into your life? Now let's have that conversation. It's not with your fancy designer suit. It's not with the restaurant that you take them to. It's not by how much money you have. That conversation now needs to happen. And I usually break it down. What I've learned from my guru, my teacher, is that there are qualities, virtues, that a human being can develop in irrespective of their life circumstances that are seen as the most attractive things to that divinity. So chief amongst them is humility, number one. So humility is the number one quality that can attract divinity into your life as a magnetic principle. Okay. So this is the first one. Then the second one would be something akin to sincerity. So you can package honesty into that. But sincerity is meaning that you really mean what you say and mean what you do. Right? There is an alignment. There's a coherence to what you're doing. Right. Third would be something like effort, because you can be sincerely lazy. So effort would be that, and I define effort as anything that extends beyond your comfort zone. Because to act within your comfort zone, even if you act and you do it consistently, it doesn't mean that you're really putting in an effort. It's comfortable, it's convenient, it's easy. So I'm talking about effort as being anything that is even just one step beyond your comfort zone. Okay, so that's effort. Then the fourth, I would say, is exactly that. I just mentioned it, consistency. Relationships are built on consistency. You have to show up every day. It's not that, well, I do my religious stuff on a Sunday. I go to church on a Sunday, but the rest of the 6 days of the week, you know, my conduct may be dubious, right? It's not really about that. It's about showing up every day. Even if you show up with poor quality, so to speak, a hallmark of sincerity, a hallmark of effort is consistency, right? So I'm talking about humility, sincerity, effort, consistency. And the fifth and final one is kindness. And into kindness, I'll wrap up compassion, right? As we had talked about it a little earlier. And so why kindness? Because a lot of sincere spiritual seekers, a lot of sincere religious seekers, they can understand concepts of consistency, effort, sincerity, but they often forget about the kindness. Extending understanding, extending compassion, extending a smile, a helping hand, positivity, right? Like these things are fundamental. One of the lines my guru loves to say when he's giving lectures, he often looks out into the crowd and there are a lot of people asking a lot of questions and sometimes a lot of people complaining about life and the difficulties of life. And he says, but if you could only face it with a smile on your face, because imagine the divine shows up and looks and says, okay, now I'm going to help this one. But he sees that miserable face you have on. It's not a very attractive proposition. And as superficial a point as it is, it's speaking to something deeper. It's really about your mindset and your approach to the difficulty, right? Poor me versus, you know, if this has been laid out in front of me, I'll take it as best I can. I'll face it as best I can, right? And so I think that this kindness, this positivity is a fundamental fifth ingredient. I've just summarized it into five. We could go on into 10, 20, but I think it's much more practical.
Why humility as number one? And what does that look like to you?
Perfect. A week ago, I was in New York City and I was giving a lecture, and there were some Yale students there who had come as invitees of a friend. And I said something similar, and he immediately honed in on that. He was like, what is that humility thing? What does that look like? And how does that relate to self-advocacy? And so here's what I had said, and I think this will help understand this. Really important that we define words. Humility means accepting things for what they are, not for what they are not. Let me paint a story so that you can maybe encapsulate this. There was once a guru, and he was about to pass away, and so he needed to appoint a successor to his students. And so he summoned all of his students, and there were about 41 of them. And he said to them, everyone who thinks they are ready to succeed me, please step forward. And 20 people stepped forward. And then he said, okay, and those who think you are unworthy to be my successors, please take a step backwards. And 20 people took a step backwards, and there was only one guy left in the original position. And so he says to him, are you deaf? You didn't hear my questions? And he says, no, I heard them perfectly well. I just don't understand how I'm supposed to measure this. Only you know what it takes to succeed you. It's not my place to say whether I am worthy or unworthy. I only know what I know. And what I don't know, I hold up my hands and say, I don't know. I don't know what it takes to succeed you. Therefore, I cannot answer your question. And the guru says, great, you're my successor. Right? The point of the story is, humility is not to say I'm nobody. It's not to say I'm nothing, poor me. Neither is it to say I'm amazing and great. That would be your pride and arrogance. It's really about stating things precisely as they are. It's when you know something, say it, live it. When you don't know something, hold your hands up and say, I don't know. Right? And so why humility is number one is because humility is the only way in which you can live in truth. Even if it is your perception of truth in that moment, it doesn't matter. To you, it's the only true thing. Anything other than that, and you know you're faking it. You know you're being fake in some way or another. If someone asks you something and you don't know the answer, but you give an answer anyway, you know you're lying in that moment. You know you're doing something you shouldn't, but you do it because you can't face the alternative, which is maybe the embarrassment of saying, I don't know, because you don't have the requisite humility, right?
I think that society really lacks that. It's funny. I've been like studying health stuff for a long time. Part of it was out of necessity. Part of it was out of like a desire to perform like physically, but then losing my health and really devoting a lot of time to trying to learn. And there's a lot of people out there willing to say what is. And one thing I've picked up on from a lot of the, influential voices in the health sphere, you rarely hear that word, I'm not sure, let me get back to you. And it really rubs me wrong. It really, like, I could take somebody that I really think I'm picking up what they're laying down, and I buy it, and then I hear them answer something, and I just know that they don't actually know, and like, damn, I wish they would just say, I'm not sure, instead of making up some, because I'm gullible. Like, I'll buy into all kinds of, I have a history, like, I'm easy to sell. I don't know why, but I am. And it's a blessing and a curse. Because I'm willing to try new things, I could be really open-minded, but also I could get caught up with stuff. So, but the thing is once I hear that, it makes it fuzzy on everything. I'm like, well, now I have to second guess everything else that you've been saying because I know you're bullshitting about this, and I pretty just like you mentioned, I know that you're bullshitting. So it's like there, and in this digital age now, where there's a world of this like decentralized information flow where everybody's got an opinion and they could share it and it could be broadcast and it could be spread, whether it's true, false, somewhere in the middle. And, you know, there's society definitely lacks that, at least in that realm, like the flow of opinions as if they're absolute truths. And there's a lot of that. That's interesting that's I would have never guessed that humility would be like, if you laid out all the things and said, what's number one, I would never guess that is. But that's really interesting that's like a foundational aspect, and I could see that being a really good to think about. I mean, it may, so if somebody was, let's say somebody wanted to integrate some of these ideas, because, and honestly, I'm one that I'm wary about buy in full to any ideology, but I also feel really like I've gotten a lot of value from pulling from every ideology that I've touched on. And I do the same thing in like with like physical fitness. I've learned tons of different modalities, and I like keep the things that I feel useful and, let go of the ones that I don't have space for or whatever, don't serve me. But if somebody wanted to like pull something from this and they're not ready to go live it on an ashram or something, and they wanted to start at this humility, like what is a framework in the mind when you're going through your day to think about, like, is there something you use that's like a prompt or a question of how you would approach a moment? What is that?
Absolutely. So just to reiterate once more, though, to buy into this whole framework, you don't need to go live in an ashram. That's really hard. I don't want to frame it that way,
I was
right?
being dramatic. Okay.
I know, I know. So the prompt would be this. It's you have to understand what is it inside of me that feeds the tendency to be dishonest in those moments, to be proud and arrogant, right? What is it? Why is it that that influencer and that mental health expert isn't able to say, I don't know, or I'm not sure, right? And it's ego. It's more than ego. It's even reputation or image. I remember once attending a lecture of a good friend of my guru, who's a very, very wise person. And someone asked him, like, what's the biggest danger for someone's spiritual journey? And he said, prestige. It's the attachment we have to the way we are seen in the minds of others, let alone the way we're seen in our own minds, right? So image, reputation, fame, all of those things, right? And the things you will do to protect that image, the things you will do to cultivate a specific image, will often betray your values, often betray your principles, often betray the truth. So when we're going through day-to-day life, one of the prompts that I think really helps us is to simply take a moment to ask ourselves, and if it doesn't happen in the moment, then at least at the end of the day, do it like an analysis of your day and try to pinpoint moments in your day where you took decisions and ask yourself the question, why? Why did I choose that particular way? So just asking the why forces you to seek your motivations out. It forces you to see why in that particular fashion and why not differently.
So just the act of observation, shining a light on it.
In a very sort of, yeah, absolutely, and in an inquisitory way, because one of the examples I give, I call it back at the temple service. So we have a temple where people congregate for prayers, and you'll always see people trying to sit near the front, as if God can't see you if you're sitting in the back, right? And so I almost remind people, like, hey, don't you want to go sit in the back today? And they're like, why? And I'm like, just to train your mind to see things differently. You don't need to be in the limelight. You don't need to be at the front of the table. You don't need to be this, that, and the other, because what part of you is attracted to that? And is it really your friend? And so just taking these examples, it doesn't mean that you have to go sit in the back. Some people sit in the back because they're trying to hide. So that's also it's not a black or white situation. It's more that seek your real motivations, what is really going on inside of you when you do those things. I remember for myself, because I started giving lectures when I was quite young and quite some time ago, maybe I wasn't as wise or ready to deal with some of the things that comes with it. So for example, you give a lecture and at the end you hang around because people might come to you and praise you and say, well done, you did an amazing job. It was phenomenal. Wow, this, that, and the other. But why do I need those things? This validation, right? I'm seeking that validation. It feels good. It massages my ego. And so I hang out. And then my guru says to me, okay, so next time you give a lecture, they just give the lecture, thank everybody, and walk out. And I was like, okay, let me see how I feel when I do that. I did it. And immediately, hundreds of reasons start coming up. So, oh, you should have hung out. Maybe they had more questions for you. Maybe they had this. Maybe they had that. But behind it all was just that one little niggly feeling of, I didn't get my validation today. I didn't get that praise. That was a nice thing, right? And so I think once you start to become aware of the way you've been orientated, the way you've programmed yourself, you can start to see why true humility is such an attractive proposition. I mean, what you were just saying about the influencers, doesn't that make you lose some kind of attraction towards those people?
It does. And also, I think of, like, when you say it's reputation on the line, and I am being compassionate, and I'm thinking, like, the digital age is brand new. So I think there are a lot of hardwired systems that at one time, if you had a bad reputation, that could cost you your life. That you're an outcast of the tribe. It might be literally life or death 1,000, 10,000 years ago if people thought poorly of you. So I could see how that neurology to protect us could manifest as somebody bullshitting on social media now. So it's like that system that was there for a good reason to help you not just survive individually, but be a part of your tribe and help them and contribute too, potentially. And, it's like maladapted when you have an audience of a million people. When, 10,000 years ago, you couldn't have an audience of more than 150 people or something. Nobody had that kind of reach. Incentive structures were different socioeconomically too. So like you didn't like our brain hardwiring hasn't caught up with the age of today. But there are people that are sincere and are practice humility, and people gravitate towards them.
They do, and
People like it.
that's the point I was going to make. Some of the best feedback I've ever got from my work is, wow, you're brutally honest to the point of even saying things about yourself that don't necessarily show you in the best light. And I'm like, right, but the outcome of that is what? I'm like, I trust you more. I actually want to listen to what you have to say more because I know you're not going to bullshit me, as you were saying earlier, right? And so opening up that vulnerability and being honest about it can be scary because you think exactly that. I'm going to weaken my image. I'm going to pay a price for this. Often it's the opposite. Often actually you gain the respect of the people and you actually have a new platform that you thought you weren't going to have. Now, I'm not denying anything you said about before. Like the reputation was a very, very important thing. And I don't disagree with that. I still think you can build a curated reputation or an intentional reputation without lying. You can be a little selective about what you show and what you don't. That isn't the same thing as building it on falsehoods.
Right. Yeah, you can. I can understand why somebody might not be good at that at today, like that same person might be different 5 years later, but it bothers me in the moment, and it just makes it harder to navigate, especially like in the health sphere. It's really common, and there's a lot of people out there really suffering, looking for answers, and maybe they've been failed by traditional medical systems in our country at least, and they're looking elsewhere. And it's like you get all kinds of shit thrown at you.
You're 100% right, but it's based on a really basic psychological thing. It's like you wouldn't go to a doctor that looks sick.
Right.
Like if you're going to get healed and then you show up and the doctor's coughing, that's a bad sign. But it's an irrational thought. It's an irrational thought. It's the idea that for me to get derived benefit from someone like this, they have to be in a perfected state themselves. And it's just not true. It's not how life actually works, but we've somehow wired ourselves to think that way.
I have to ask you, I noticed, immediately when I saw you online that you have these like badass markings on your face. What is that about?
Yeah, so it's one of those features of Hinduism that, it makes a lot of sense within the Indian cultural setting. And then the minute you step out of that, it's just wild. Like, what is this, right? You got face paint on, war paint, whatever it is. So basically, in traditional India, what you had is you had different lineages or different schools of thought, of practice, etc. And these markings would be the way of like marking of your tribe in a sense. It's the way you show affiliation, right? So when someone sees the mark, they already know your family, so to speak, like where which teaching you come from, which lineage you come from. And so this has persisted. Now, in the Christian world, for example, I often tell people this, the same thing exists, just in a less obvious way. So they'll wear a cross, and the Catholic cross is different from the Orthodox cross, which is different from the Jerusalem cross, which is different from this cross. And so there will be a marking that denotes the specific denomination of your faith, right? Now, Christians will often do it wearing a necklace. I'm doing it by putting it on my forehead, but that's because of the cultural background from which it stems from. But the intent is actually the same. It's a statement or declaration of faith or denomination in that sense. Now, this particular one, it's called tilak. So tilak is the name for these markings that Hindus wear on their forehead. And so what you'll often find is they'll have either these vertical ones or horizontal ones. Those are the two major variants. So horizontal markings are ascribed to people who worship Shiva. If you've ever heard about Hindu deity, so Shiva being, if people consider Shiva to be the supreme lord, then Shiva, they wear horizontal. And vertical are those who consider Vishnu to be the supreme deity. And so they have a symbology, they have meanings. The white lines represent the feet of God, for example. So we put it on our forehead because as a sign of humility, we understand. Remember, I told you humility is about being honest in a sense of what we are and what we are not. So for us, we understand that we are at the feet, we place our lives at the feet of God in an act of surrender and worship, of love, not in the sense of again, not in the sense of poor me, in the sense of willing surrender, so that we have these markings on our head as a daily spiritual reminder for ourselves and within the wider cultural context as a representation, sorry, of our affiliation.
Nice. Do you feel like that helps you have a more real-time reminder when you're going through your day? Like the fact that you're wearing those to like keep your head on those, like on those list of things on the devotion,
All of these things are
keeps your head in
mental.
the game.
All of these things are mental cues. That's what it all is. I could live my same life with no markings, with no robes, just wearing a very different set of clothes and having a very different identity. My name, my markings, this clothes, these are all mental cues towards an identity that I've chosen to take on that is more aligned with my actual goals of life. I could do this differently, no problem. The reason that I do this is because it works. It's the same reason that someone shows up in a uniform to work. You take on the identity of the person you have to be at that workspace, right? The police officer, when he puts on the police uniform, he is now in the identity of police officer more so than he is in his own, right? His own personal identity. And I think that this, for me, obviously it's not a 9-to-5 job. This is my life that I've taken on because I actually am trying to make this my full-time identity. In the sense, not of the externalities, but in the sense of what this represents.
Well, sounds like you found something you're pretty passionate about, and sounds like you're helping make the world a better place. Your podcast, Thinking Bhatki, other than people checking that out, how else do they get in contact? You said you travel and do workshops and teachings?
So the best thing to do would be to go to my Instagram. So because on my Instagram, obviously I'll share more about what I'm doing on a sort of week to week basis. Right now, I'm just really excited because my spiritual teacher, my guru, Paramahamsa Vishwananda, he's coming to America. He actually arrives as of the day of this recording tomorrow. So he'll be spending all of August and half of September in North America between the United States and Canada. So my focus is going to be on that, on supporting that tour and making that tour the success that it's going to be. He'll be giving a so we have what we what he does. This is the thing that I wanted to sort of touch on as well, because we asked at the very beginning how I got into all of this, right? And it was about meeting him. So he makes these situations possible through what we call a darshan. So darshan is an event where he comes, he speaks, he gives a lecture, he sings. He likes to sing a lot. Bhakti tradition is a lot about singing as well. And then he gives a one-to-one blessing to each person. So every person who attends can come and see him. So sometimes he spends 10, 15 hours nonstop sitting there just receiving people one-on-one. He will not leave until everybody's gone, basically. And so this is going to happen in New York City on the 9th of August. He's going to have one of those events there for the first time. And people can come in and meet him and have that one-to-one time with him. And I often tell people, have zero expectations. It might be 30 seconds of your life wasted, but you'll still have good music, good people, and a good time. Or it might be something that serves as a catalyst to transform your life for the better. So it's really something that I advise people to experience for themselves. It's a wonderful thing that helped change my life and the lives of thousands of people around the world. So, 9th of August in New York City. If people want to find out more, they should come to my Instagram page and the Instagram page of the organization that I'm a part of. So that would be Bhakti Marga America. That would be the best thing to do.
Okay. Well, Swami Revati, I really enjoyed this. I really appreciate that you're out there doing what you're doing, and honored to be a conduit for your message, and hope that our paths cross again sometime. Really enjoyed you taking the time. And for the listeners out there, always grateful for your listening. I hope you enjoyed the conversation. And check out Swami's Instagram and maybe make your way to New York and let his guru sing to you.
Thank you so much, Les. It's been really a pleasure.
All right, have a great day, everybody.